Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Sasha Adi, host of the PCOS Challenge radio show, designed to help women overcome polycystic ovarian syndrome, a hormonal and reproductive disorder that affects 1 in 10 women of childbearing age. We'll be bringing you the best information on fertility, hirsutism, weight loss, nutrition, mental health, and other conditions surrounding PCOS. The goal of the PCOS Challenge is to inspire and motivate you to make positive changes in your life. So tune in regularly to get insights from leading experts and the support you need. This is Sasha Adi. Help spread the word and take the PCOS Challenge. Hello, everyone. This is Sasha Adi, your host of the PCOS Challenge radio show and also the PCOSChallenge.com support and networking site. Today, we're covering a very important topic. It's PCOS and your cardiovascular health. I know a lot of people are worried about other conditions surrounding PCOS. However, one thing that we really do need to realize is that PCOS affects multiple systems of the body, and our cardiovascular system is very much one of those systems that we need to pay close attention to. Our guest today is Dr. Gregory Pokrivka, and he's a board-certified internist from Baltimore, Maryland. He attended Duke University and worked as a biochemist there, and afterwards attended University of Maryland Medical School and was chief resident in the internal medicine at Mercy Hospital in Baltimore. He now serves as assistant professor for the Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine, and he's been in private practice since 1987, he knows what he's doing, and formed the Baltimore Lipid Center in 2001. Dr. Pokrivka is a member of numerous associations, too numerous to mention right now, including the American Heart Association Council on Atherosclerosis and the National Lipid Association. He participates enthusiastically in the Go Red for Women and Women Heart Campaigns to Fight Heart Disease in Women. Dr. Pokrivka, thank you so much for being a part of the PCOS Challenge radio show today.
Thank you so much, Sasha. I'm glad to be here. And please feel free to call me Dr. P. That might be a little easier for myself and for listeners, and I hear it all day anyway.
Okay, Dr. P. Okay, so we're covering the topic of cardiovascular health specifically in women with PCOS today. And like I mentioned before, I think this is a very important topic for us to discuss, and I'm so happy that you're here to help to educate people on this topic.
Absolutely. It's a critical topic, Sasha, because American women may not be aware of this, but this is what American women die from, both with and without PCOS. I know if you survey American women, they're very much concerned about breast cancer, obviously, and for good reason, but you're 10 times as likely to die from a cardiovascular illness. So this is a critical issue, and we have such wonderful interventional tools to prevent this disease and treat it. We just need to get out there and assess risk better and get the right women to the right doctors to make the changes.
Yes, and also help people to become more aware that this is a real risk. So, and then people pay more attention to it.
Absolutely.
Okay, so the first question I have for you is, this is a term that many women with PCOS hear on a daily basis. Insulin resistance, what is it?
Insulin resistance means that the insulin you have, that we all have, isn't working properly. This term insulin resistance means that the The blood sugar tends to rise, although that's occurs fairly late in the phenomena. But the risk of cardiovascular disease, the damage to the arteries, the building of plaque, the increased risk for cardiovascular events such as strokes and heart attacks and such can occur much earlier than the rise in the sugar level, the glucose level that we usually associate with insulin. You know, patients hear insulin, they think insulin injections, diabetes, et cetera, but long before that, decades before, the body can become resistant to insulin and begin to build up cardiovascular risk.
Right, and this is not something we think about, like you mentioned. We do think about primarily about diabetes and blood sugar, but it's all connected, right?
Absolutely. When you have conditions such as PCOS, where you tend to accumulate excessive body fat in the midsection, that fat secretes really a toxic stew of chemicals into the bloodstream that causes the blood pressure to rise, the arteries to fill with plaque. It eventually causes the body to be unable to regulate sugar control. So the risk of both diabetes and cardiovascular disease goes up. We use the term cardiometabolic risk, kind of big word, but it means the risk of cardiac disease as well as metabolic disease like diabetes goes up in a condition like PCOS, particularly when the waist in a woman is greater than about 35 inches at the hips. And many women aren't used to measuring their waists or having the physician measure it. I would poll your listeners and say, you know, how many women have had their waist measured by a practitioner in the last year. You know, it's something that we do routinely here at the Baltimore Lipid Center.
Wow. And yeah, we hear about the waist to hip ratio, none of my doctors have ever measured my waist.
I can tell you that we certainly do it here. If you come in for a sore throat, you know, I can probably do more for you by measuring your waist and saying we need to look into this than I can by prescribing an antibiotic for a fairly harmless condition. So the magic number there is 35 inches in Caucasian women. In most American women, South Asian patients, maybe a little bit less because they have a smaller body frame. Maybe 32, 33 inches would be the cutoff there. But at about 35 inches, risk begins to steeply climb. So that's a very easy assessment tool. All I need is a waist measurement and a triglyceride measurement, and I can get a pretty good idea of what's going on with cardiometabolic risk in a patient.
Well, let me ask you this, Dr. P. So why is it that so many women report that the magic number that many doctors are looking for has to do with weight, body weight?
We certainly measure body mass index, which is a way that you take weight and adjust it for height. But it's really the distribution of the weight that's important. When weight is in the midsection, you tend to get this generation of toxic substances that cause all the changes I had mentioned before. So it's really the distribution of weight, the body composition. We've recently started to do body composition measuring with a bioimpedance monitor in the office where we can look at percent body fat mass in women, which is usually higher than men, and it's going to be even higher in these insulin-resistant conditions. So, the presence of a lot of body fat, particularly when it's in the waist, is an increased indicator for diabetes and heart disease.
Okay. And so what is metabolic syndrome? I know that name is a little bit controversial, but what is it?
Absolutely. Well, the reason why the term metabolic syndrome is controversial is we haven't yet quite identified a gene for it. It's sort of an artificial construct to describe a type of patient with sort of the apple-shaped obesity pattern where patients have their weight in the midsection. And there are five characteristics of it. One would be the waist greater than 35 inches that I mentioned, greater than 32, 33 inches in South Asian women. That's one criteria. Another one would be a fasting blood sugar, a glucose, which is commonly measured. If that's greater than 100, that would be the second factor. You have to have three of these five factors, and then you're considered to have metabolic syndrome, abnormal metabolism. The third factor would be a blood pressure greater than 130 over 85. greater than or equal. So that's would be considered a, you know, a high normal blood pressure under most standard risk assessment strategies. A high triglyceride count would be the fourth measurement. Triglycerides are one of the body's blood fats, and we can spend more time on that later if you want. A triglyceride greater than 150 would qualify you. And then the fifth characteristic would be an HDL cholesterol. That's the good or healthy cholesterol, so to speak, less than 50. Three of those five characteristics, okay. You have the metabolic syndrome, your risk of diabetes and cardiovascular disease is dramatically elevated.
Yeah, because a lot of women with PCOS are also told that they have metabolic syndrome.
Absolutely. It can be a very high percentage in American women, 60 to 80%. The terms aren't synonymous, but very high incidence of metabolic syndrome in PCOS patients.
Wow. So I'm going to ask you to explain a few more terms, and then we'll go into triglycerides and other fats. So what's hypertension, and how does that correlate into your cardiovascular health and your risk for metabolic syndrome and other cardiovascular diseases?
Sure. Well, when we talk about most hypertension in this country is what we call essential hypertension, meaning that it's not due to the fact that you had to run up the steps to get to your doctor's office, or you had a stressful day, or your heart rate is pounding because you don't like being your doctor. Essential hypertension means that your blood pressure in a nice, quiet, resting state is going to be above 140 over 90 would be the formal definition for metabolic syndrome. It's a little lower, 130 over 85. The ideal blood pressure for a human being is probably less than 120 over 80. And as the blood pressure increases, the cardiovascular risk increases. It damages the arteries when the blood pressure is up. That allows cholesterol to get in and build up plaque. It makes the heart work harder. You know how your muscles, Sasha, get bigger when you go and work out at the gym, and this could
right.
be... This could be productive if you want to build muscle mass and if you want to look good, and muscle is certainly better than fat as far as its effect upon cardiovascular health. But it's not good when your heart gets bigger. When your blood pressure is elevated, even a modest amount over a lifetime, the heart enlarges and it can eventually fail. So that's known as heart failure. So hypertension, high blood pressure, is a very important risk factor, and it's really one of the easiest to treat, both with lifestyle changes and medications.
Now, I recently went to the doctor, and I felt my blood pressure was a bit elevated, but he didn't seem too concerned. And you said that's a risk factor. However, they didn't seem too concerned. And that worries me because I'm sure a lot of women see that, and that's a simple enough risk factor. However, no further investigation was done. So how do other doctors, internists, usually look at the numbers associated with your blood?
Well, I think what really should be done is hypertension is clearly one of the big five major risk factors that are involved with cardiovascular disease. So when I see one of these factors, such as high blood pressure, I really look for the other ones because it's clustering of symptoms. The risk factors are additive. And, you know, many times patients don't want to be on a pill. They don't want to be on another medicine. It's sometimes hard to motivate patients to make appropriate lifestyle changes like reducing salt and losing weight and exercising. All these things work to reduce blood pressure, and they all reduce cardiovascular risk. So I think, you know, we as clinicians sometimes aren't hard enough on patients, and we don't really say, well, you know, we need to do something about this. You know, patients say, well,
right.
It's just up today because I had a rough day, and I take my blood pressure at home and it's lower. You know, you can certainly show that blood pressure for many patients is lower at home, but we have 40 years of evidence, maybe 50 now, that if we reduce the blood pressure in the office, we can reduce events. We can reduce plaque buildup. We can reduce strokes. We can reduce heart disease. So we really have to take both the home readings and the office readings into account when we decide to treat a patient.
Right. Okay. And so what is dyslipidemia and what causes it?
Oh boy! And I'll try to give you the short answer on that one, Sasha.
Okay.
That one I could—that's my absolute favorite
you
topic
could be,
to talk about.
Spend all day on
but,
that.
But I've talked about it enough, and I talk about it with every single patient. So I think I'm reasonably good at it. So I would look at it this way: we should think of lipids as fats. Very simple. We
right.
need fats in our body to construct cells, and we need fats for fuel, et cetera. But dyslipidemia would be when the fats are going into the wrong places. Such as into the wall of the arteries, building up plaque, an increasing risk for heart attacks, strokes, clogging of the arteries leading to the kidneys, for example, can lead to kidney failure. There are many manifestations of cardiovascular disease. The biggest organ in your body is really the lining of the arteries, the endothelium, it's called, the single cell layer. And when you have abnormal fats, the endothelium doesn't work right. When your blood pressure's up, or when you smoke, when you don't exercise, there are many factors that make this endothelium not function properly. And then the lipids get in, cause plaque buildup, and eventually over a lifetime cause events. So dyslipidemia means abnormal transportation of fats in the body. That's how I would look at it.
Okay. That's a really good explanation.
Absolutely.
So when you come to me,
Sasha, and your blood pressure is even mm-hmm. a little bit borderline, I'm thinking, well, what else is going on in Sasha? Could her,
mm-hmm.
she have dyslipidemia? Could she have high blood sugar? Could she have, family history? Maybe everybody in her family has high blood pressure, and they're all having cardiovascular disease in early age. So we look, when we see one little risk factor, we begin to think of the other ones and look for clusters of patterns.
And you start to investigate.
Absolutely. That's what internal medicine is about. We're the investigators. We don't replace
yeah.
knees or do sinus surgery or do other. I mean, we're the investigators. Internists, see a
and
problem.
And you're also the first line of defense when it comes
absolutely.
To medicine for a lot of people. Yes.
Absolutely. The internist, I find many women in middle age or have a GYN, they go on a regular basis, but they may just have a primary care doctor they just go to when they have a cough or a cold or their elbow hurts or whatever. They're not really getting good cardiovascular screening done on a regular basis.
Very important. So, okay, so what, this is one of your favorite words, I'm sure. Tell us what triglycerides are. And why should we even care about them, and why they're important to look into?
Well, Sasha, triglycerides are one of the two major fats that we're going to talk about when we talk about dyslipidemia. The fats are
mm-hmm.
cholesterol and triglycerides, and these fats are essential for life. If you're born without cholesterol, you die very rapidly. You need cholesterol for many useful functions. You need triglycerides as fuel. So triglycerides are another form of fat, really the forgotten lipid. Recent data has shown that cholesterol levels in Americans are falling. We're getting the picture to restrict some of the cholesterol and saturated fats in our diet, but triglycerides are rising. This is a study called NHANES, NHANES, clearly shows a dramatic rise along with obesity in America over the last few decades. And when the triglycerides are really one of the fats that come out of this disordered metabolism that you get when you get a syndrome of insulin resistance, when you have the buildup of abnormal fat cells in the midsection, you're going to get disordered trafficking of triglyceride in the bloodstream. Triglyceride is normally transported in particles called lipoproteins. And some of the listeners may be familiar with things like LDL and HDL and various other components of the standard lipid
mm-hmm.
panel that most of us have had at one time or the other.
Absolutely.
But there's not a good awareness of triglycerides, unfortunately, and there really should be, because triglycerides are markers for the abnormal transportation of fats in the blood, the transportation of fats into the artery instead of where they should go. So we have to pay a lot more attention to triglycerides.
Yeah, and cholesterol is the other fat that we have to pay attention to.
Yes, Absolutely. And the way I explain this to patients, what we do here differently at the Baltimore Lipid Center than what most American physicians are doing is we are trying to determine where the fats are going, not what they are.
Mm.
So if you tell me, Sasha, your triglyceride count is 170, let's just pick a number, I would say that's mm-hmm. modestly elevated. Women should pay attention to any triglyceride count above 150. It's certainly abnormal, probably even above 120, 130, we're starting to get into the abnormal range. So everyone should find out what their triglyceride is, and if it's abnormal, they should certainly bring this to their physician's attention. And if their physician is not concerned about it, then they should really potentially seek out a specialist in lipid disorders, such as myself, a clinical lipidologist. And we can talk more about later, if you want, how you can find one. But a triglyceride
yeah.
count of 170 is definitely abnormal. This would be an indicator that the patient has insulin resistance, that the patient has a lot of LDL particles in the bloodstream dumping off cholesterol and triglycerides into the arteries that cause plaque buildup. So triglycerides are a critical factor driving heart disease in American women today, and they don't get the attention that they should. Most physicians are much more obsessed with cholesterol determinations
with cholesterol,
and not paying enough.
Yeah.
And not paying enough attention to triglycerides.
Yeah. So what fats or what lipids should we be, what is there a panel that we should be testing? Or
yes, absolutely.
That our doctors should be testing, that they should be looking out for?
Yes, I would say that, and certainly all American women should be screened with a lipid panel. The recommendations of the NCEP and the ATP panels or consensus panels would say something like every 5 years an American adult should have a lipid panel after about age 20. And we now even have some criteria for doing these in pediatric patients. If you have polycystic ovarian syndrome, however, the standard lipid panel, which is a total cholesterol, an LDL cholesterol, a bad cholesterol, the HDL cholesterol, the, quote, good cholesterol, and a triglyceride count. The standard lipid panel, however, is inaccurate in women with triglycerides who are elevated, above approximately 150 or so. In any insulin-resistant patient, the standard lipid panel is less accurate. And there are other blood tests such as lipoprotein panels, simple and readily available blood tests that actually count the particles in the bloodstream that dump off cholesterol and triglycerides into the arteries and cause plaque buildup. So there are forms of advanced lipoprotein testing through laboratories such as HDL. That is a laboratory from Richmond. There's a company called LipoScience that does advanced testing. There's SpectraCell, there's VAP, and there's Berkeley. So there are a number of companies that do advanced lipoprotein testing. And certainly any woman with PCOS, especially anyone with high triglycerides, should ask her doctor for one of these specialized tests. You and I can put these resources on your website. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear.
Absolutely.
You and I can put these resources on the website.
Okay, yes, absolutely. So I was asking you, would most doctors have access to these other panels, these other tests?
They would. I would say that any American physician can get these lab panels through one of the standard national reference labs, such as Quest or LabCorp. I'm sure there are other ones, but those are the two big ones that we see. The problem is, Sasha, unfortunately, most American physicians are just doing standard lipid panels, and they're not.
Absolutely.
They're familiar with these other tests, but they're not sure how to interpret the results. They're not sure which patients to order them. And the patient, as you know, has to be their own advocate. And if your physician is not familiar with it, right? If your physician is not familiar with this, you have to go find someone who is.
Absolutely. And do you know if this is a standard in Europe and other countries as well?
Absolutely. There's an advanced test called an ApoB test. APO. Capital B. ApoB testing is a more accurate way to count cholesterol particles than the standard lipid panel. The other thing that any patient can do, there are probably listeners right now who might have their lipid panel right in front of them, their last set of cholesterol numbers. If you take the total cholesterol and subtract the HDL cholesterol. Okay, so if my total cholesterol is 150 and my HDL cholesterol is 50, I subtract, I get 100. That is the non-HDL cholesterol, non-HDL cholesterol. That number should be less than approximately 130 in PCOS women, essentially in all women, but in women with PCOS and increased risk. Yeah, we want to make sure that number is less than 130. So anyone out there who's listening, just take your total cholesterol, subtract your HDL cholesterol. If it's greater than 130, you have a problem. You have a potential problem, and you should get advanced testing. You should bring this to your physician's attention, et cetera. I had mentioned to you earlier, Sasha, there's anyone can find a lipid specialist, someone who is a member of the National Lipid Association, such as myself, or even those who have obtained further certifications, such as a board-certified lipidologist, is what we call ourselves, specialist in lipids.
Yeah.
There's a website called, very easy to remember, learnyourlipids.com. So LEARNYOUR, lipids, LIPIDS.com. Anyone can go to learnyourlipids.com. It's a non-branded website. You can put in your zip code and find out where some of the nearest lipid experts are. So anyone can see. Maybe your own physician is on there and perhaps isn't aware that you have PCOS, for example, or else you could go to a specialist for consultation.
Well, thanks for the great information. Before we continue,
sure.
We haven't gotten your contact information yet. So could you give us your contact information? How can we reach you?
Oh, absolutely. Really, the best way to reach me, you're talking about phone numbers, websites, emails,
yes,
that kind of stuff?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Really, the best way to get me would be simply by email at GPOKMD. That's G as in Gregory, P as in Paul, OK, MD as in medical doctor, at Verizon.net. That's V-E-R-I-Z-O-N, Verizon.net. That's probably the best way to reach me by far. I'm embarrassed to
and
say.
And you're in the Baltimore, Maryland
and
area.
And I'm in the Baltimore
right?
area and the Towson area, Baltimore. I don't know if I'm allowed to give out my office phone number here. That's fine with me.
Yes, you are.
Sure.
Yes,
it's,
you are.
I never know what the rules are, Sasha. Let me tell you, the rules that we lecture under these days as physicians change every week. I was at gave a lecture recently where I could say one thing on one color carpet and I had to say you couldn't say it on a different color carpet depending on where I was standing. So, so I always ask. The number here for the office for the Baltimore Lipid Center is 410-337-0720. So that's 410-337-0720. And I was about to say, I'm almost embarrassed to say, I don't know if I remember what my own website is here. I had to look it up because I don't give
it
out that often.
I'll post it.
But,
yeah.
But I can
okay.
certainly, we can certainly post that on it. But I return all emails, and I would be happy to help anyone.
Great. So is there a way, are there symptoms of cardiovascular disease that people can pay attention to?
Absolutely. There are symptoms, but you have to remember that this is largely a disease that occurs over many decades, and so we really want to try to catch it before there are symptoms, because unfortunately, one of the most common presenting symptoms is sudden death when someone has their first heart attack. Right. So we really have to emphasize prevention in women. So that's point number one. You should think of this as a silent killer. I'm old enough to remember those commercials, maybe from the 60s and 70s, a hugely successful campaign talking about hypertension. So we should think of atherosclerosis as a buildup of plaque, cardiovascular disease as a silent killer. Now, the other thing that's difficult about women compared to men is that women often have very vague symptoms when they present with their cardiovascular disease, because the disease is different in women than it is in men. Let me tell you what I mean by that. The classic male presentation of angina, chest pain, precursor of a heart attack, the male will be out shoveling snow or doing something exertional and feel a weight-like pressure in the chest that then goes away when he rests. That's a classic symptom we see commonly in men, and you can see this in women also. But in women, because the arteries are smaller than in men, and because we don't get as much obstructive plaque buildup, in other words, the disease manifests itself somewhat differently in women. Women can have vaguer symptoms, such as just unexplained fatigue, unexplained shortness of breath, you know, chest pains that may not be as classic as the classic snow shoveling elephant-like pressure on the chest. So we have to be, you know, very careful in women that we take anything like this seriously, and that we, you know, do a full evaluation.
And there's so many other things that cause fatigue, and you know,
exactly.
A lot of women with PCOS complain about being fatigued for, you know, and there are many causes, many reasons. So it definitely warrants investigation.
Absolutely, particularly if I would say fatigue with exercise, you know, poor exercise tolerance, any kind of exercise-related symptoms is often a sign of cardiovascular disease. Now most women are not going to get cardiovascular disease in their 30s and 40s. Typically, women lag about 10 years behind men. But any unexplained symptom really needs to be investigated from a cardiovascular standpoint, because the results can be so devastating if we miss substantial cardiovascular disease.
Okay, but so why is cardiovascular disease increased in women with PCOS?
Well, the main reason for that is because women with PCOS tend to have this outpouring of toxic substances from their central fat depot, the pot belly, so to speak, or as some would say when you get to menopause, the menopot. Is a term we use in the North American Menopause Society. I'm sure some of our listeners are unfortunately familiar with that. But this buildup of abnormal fat in the midsection tends to produce a lot of LDL particles, the sort of dump trucks, if you will, that carry fats, cholesterol, and triglycerides into the arteries, cause a buildup of plaque in the arterial wall, and then cause events later in life. So if you couple that with the insulin resistance, when the sugars go up, when you have a pre-diabetic state, a lot of the body's proteins don't work properly. This, once again, assaults the wall of the arteries. They don't function properly. You get plaque buildup. You toss in some high blood pressure in there, and that makes everything worse also. So we really have this toxic stew of risk factors, which is much more prevalent in PCOS women than in non-PCOS women who are the same age.
That is such a great way to put it, this toxic stew of
risk
factors.
And when the time comes, you know, we can talk about how we make the stew less toxic. You know, whenever you're ready,
yeah,
we can talk about
treatment. And we're definitely looking forward to that. I'm going to break and ask you a few listener questions before
Sure.
we get into more of my questions. Carla wants to know if, and she's obviously done her research, she wants to know if women with PCOS should be concerned about their homocysteine levels, especially if they're taking metformin.
Boy, that is a great question.
I
have to say, homocysteine metabolic breakdown product of protein metabolism. It tends to rise in certain conditions, particularly people with bad kidneys. I've seen several patients today with high homocysteine levels. I can tell you that very much on topic, I was just at the Cleveland Clinic, one of the world's great hospitals, yesterday, discussing homocysteine elevations with people that know far more about this than me. And when homocysteine levels are elevated above about 12, what this means is the patient is far more likely to have a cardiovascular event, and we need to pay more attention to that patient. We have to treat other treatable risk factors, such as the blood lipids, the high blood pressure, et cetera. Now, trials directed at lowering homocysteine have been failures. To my knowledge, there's never been a successful trial where we target homocysteine with, for example, folic acid and B12, and et cetera. All these trials have been failures.
Mm-hmm.
So to the listener, I would say if your homocysteine level is above 12, this basically means you're at increased risk. We need to look at things that we can change, such as the other risk factors I mentioned, and we need to really focus on that, try to get, you know, the cholesterol particle levels down to a lower level, try to get the triglycerides down to a lower level. It shifts the patient into a higher risk category. You know, all of our treatment strategies are based upon risk categories. We categorize a patient as, you know, low risk, medium risk, high risk, very high risk. And then we have certain targets that are probably too complex, you know, to get into here unless there's a direct question. But basically, homocysteine is a risk factor. It means we have to pay more attention to that patient, and we have to treat them as a higher risk patient. Now, I'm not that familiar with metformin increasing homocysteine. That may have been reported. I'm not that familiar with that, and I could certainly look into that specifically for that listener if she emails me.
Probably, you mentioned people with kids, you know, metformin, some people have reported it affecting the kidneys. You know.
Right. That may be what the connection is, because no, that's exactly correct. Because in some cases, now metformin is a very safe drug in general. I'm sure your listeners are very familiar with that drug. It's one of the mainstays of PCOS treatment. There's actually some evidence that metformin may reduce plaque buildup. It reduces another marker of this toxic stew that I talked about earlier. I know you like that term, but the toxic stew creates a marker called C-reactive protein. Which is, again, a marker for diabetes risk and cardiovascular risk, and metformin's been shown to lower that. So, you know, certainly metformin is a superb drug from a cardiovascular standpoint.
Yeah, and metabolic standpoint as well.
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, so the next question is from Lydia. She's a smoker with PCOS.
Okay.
And she says she knows it's bad. She tried to quit many times. She wants to know how exactly smoking is really affecting her heart and what she can do to stop smoking.
Sure. That was a great question. What smoking does, its effects are multiple. Let's go with the good news first. If Lydia quits smoking, her cardiovascular risk goes down dramatically in a week. It's not normal
in one week,
because what happens is the platelets, which are in the bloodstream, responsible for causing our blood to clot when you cut yourself shaving or whatever, and you bleed, the platelets cause us to stop bleeding. Well, the platelets can become sort of hyperactive in the smoking state. They're really sticky. So that if Lydia has a heart attack or a stroke or some other cardiovascular event, her platelets are going to be stickier. She's going to get a bigger plaque buildup, greater potential for more damage to her heart, greater sudden death potential, et cetera. So, you know, a lot of that risk, a substantial portion of it, let's say, goes away when you quit smoking within a week, because you make new platelets, and they're fresh new platelets. They haven't been hit by all the toxins and cigarette smoke, et cetera. So there's the good news for Lydia. I'm an optimist at heart, so we lead off with the good news.
That's great.
Now the bad news is that we have been using a readily available study called carotid IMT, which is an ultrasound test to measure plaque in the carotid arteries in the neck. It's very easy to do. No radiation can be done in the office. Lydia could be compared with other women her age. We could see how much plaque buildup she has. And this is one way of sort of assessing risk in addition to the blood tests and waist measurement and other things we've talked about. I can tell you the worst patients in my practice have been the smokers. So there is no doubt whatsoever, based upon the literature and my own anecdotal experience, that smoking causes a lot of plaque buildup. It damages
so
the arteries.
You say the worst.
I'm saying the people with the most amount of plaque.
You mean the highest risk patients, right?
Well, I'm saying people with the most plaque. We're talking about physically measuring plaque with this carotid study now. I have four of these sitting on my desk, and I'm going to interpret later tonight. And the smokers are always the worst. So smoking damages that endothelial layer, the layer that lines the arteries, that keeps all the bad dump trucks and LDL particles and triglyceride particles. You know, the endothelium keeps all that stuff out. It gets damaged by smoking more than any other risk factor. Hypertension is also a major risk factor, but smoking is among the worst. So I'm sure that Lydia has more plaque buildup than the average woman her age. And you combine that with the PCOS, and she probably, you know, is at high risk. So that's why she needs to quit smoking.
Yeah, I'm sure she knows. That
right. Well, I just try to paint the picture. There actually are studies that if you show patients what their arteries look like, this sort of motivates
That will motivate
people.
You.
Yeah, because a lot of medicine is motivation. I've told your listeners some fantastic things today. I hope that will help them in managing their cardiovascular risk. But it's just like a football game. You know, every play on the chalkboard is designed to be a touchdown. It's up to the patient to go out and execute. And if Lydia sees what her arteries look like, it might help her to execute. So
now, what can she do to quit smoking? She said she's tried before and has failed at that.
Sure. Well, there are a number of pharmacologic products that, or first, before we mention pharmacologic products, certainly hypnosis can be used. I have several cardiology colleagues in the near vicinity who use medical hypnosis for smoking cessation. Certainly there are some pharmacologic products out there, such as nicotine patches. Nicotine gum is a bit tougher to use, but nicotine patches are out there. There are a couple of pills that can be used, such as one called Wellbutrin, which is also marketed as an antidepressant. And then the greatest smoking cessation rate of all, if you look at 1 year success, that's really the marker of success in quitting smoking. Many people, like Lydia, probably quit for a few weeks. But if you can quit for a year, you're much more likely to stay away from it. And there's a drug called Chantix. I don't recall the generic name, but that drug is out there. It's safe. It has a very high success rate. So that could certainly be tried.
Okay. All right. Thank you. Well,
you're welcome.
So let's get into how to prevent cardiovascular diseases.
Absolutely. Well, the key really for the patient is to be their own advocate, you know, to go to the physician and make sure you're getting appropriate screening. You want to have things like your waist circumference measured. You want to track your body mass index, not necessarily just the weight, because weight can be deceptive in women. You want to look at the body mass index, which any physician can do. It should be done as a routine portion of the visit. You want to get some form of lipid panel. We start out with a standard lipid panel. You can calculate your non-HDL cholesterol, as we talked about, the total cholesterol minus the HDL. If that's greater than 130, you've got a problem that needs to be addressed at least with lifestyle change and maybe medication. I would say that women with PCOS at least should be tracked with non-HDL cholesterols, and if that's abnormal, they really should seek out a physician who's doing advanced lipoprotein testing. That's the testing that I mentioned a little bit before. These are tests that almost every physician has access to, or even nurse practitioners. We should say this is Nurse Practitioner Week, and I'm actually lecturing to the Pennsylvania Coalition of Nurse Practitioners on Saturday morning. So we have to give a big handout for nurse practitioners as frontline healthcare providers who certainly are very familiar with PCOS, and certainly there are many nurse practitioners who are very familiar with everything that I'm talking about today and are involved with the National Lipid Association. So any patient who has an elevated non-HDL cholesterol should certainly find someone who's doing advanced lipid and lipoprotein testing and use that as a better way to track where the patient's at and to track different interventions. I think your listeners know that anyone essentially with PCOS who's over the age of 40 or has a strong family history of diabetes, et cetera, should certainly have a glucose tolerance test. The standard two-hour glucose tolerance test will often pick up abnormalities that are missed if you just look at a fasting blood sugar. And then the other thing to do, obviously, would be to assess blood pressure and monitor that, you know, very carefully. We should have pay much more attention. We should pay attention to hypertension in everyone, but particularly in someone who's a PCOS patient. So there's really four, you know, sort of an outline of four things, and this is from the standard guidelines written by colleagues of mine in terms of reducing cardiovascular risk and assessing risk in PCOS patients.
It sounds simple enough, you know.
Right.
It sounds simple enough, but what?
Every play is a touchdown on the chalkboard, like we just said. Right? Sounds simple enough.
Exactly. Sounds simple enough. But some people are even scared of finding out this news from their doctor. It's kind of alarming how many people are just terrified of finding out this information. How would you encourage a patient who has received, you know, the news that they're at higher risk for cardiovascular diseases, even metabolic syndrome. How would you encourage your patients to proceed and start acting to prevent?
Well, I would begin, you know, it's always in real estate, it's location, location, location. In this mm-hmm. field, my field, it's education, education, education. You know, we just need to mm-hmm. educate patients that, you know, this is your life. These are serious illnesses that can rob you of years of quality life, either through the ultimate event, sudden death, or by causing something like heart failure or another manifestation of cardiovascular disease later in life. So I think all women seem to know someone who's had breast cancer or have had an impact of someone close to them, but heart disease in women tends to present a little bit later in life. So it's not something that a lot of our PCOS listeners may have had a personal experience with, but the time is really in the 30s and 40s, and we have proven strategies that really aren't that difficult. You know, we just need to make patients aware of this, and you know, maybe patients are afraid they're going to be put on medications, which would certainly are used and when used appropriately. But there's so many things you can do with lifestyle change. You know, the real treatment mm-hmm. for metabolic syndrome is lifestyle change, not necessarily medication.
Let's get into that.
Sure.
What types of lifestyle specifically?
Well, we're talking about, I'm a huge advocate of both exercise and nutrition. Let's talk about exercise briefly first. There's a wonderful website called exerciseismedicine.org. Simple enough to spell, exerciseismedicine.org. And I've had much delight the last few years in giving my patients exercise prescriptions. The patients are shocked. They say, well, you're not going to give me a drug.
Love it.
I'm going to write a prescription. Well, what do you want me to do? I want you to walk a half hour a day at a brisk pace. We make very much use of pedometers here. I'm wearing mine right now, and I'm sad to say I have a miserable level of exercise on mine today. Today is a non-workout day for me, Sasha. But we try to get people.
You're entitled to your rest days.
Yeah. Well, it's a typical. Here's a great example. A typical person who goes to an office and goes home like me and doesn't do much else in a day might walk about 3,000 steps in a day. I have long strides. I'm tall, so it might be a little more for some other people. But that's a fairly sedentary existence. Now, I have had days when I was in Cleveland yesterday at the Cleveland Clinic where I put 12,000 steps on just walking around between the buildings. It's fantastic. I have other days I go to the gym. But the main thing is to get moving. You know, we have to take the Nike symbol here and say you have to just do it. You know, the American Heart Association recommends a half hour a day of moderate intensity walking, and we have evidence that when that's coupled with even a modest weight loss, we'll come to in a moment, you can reduce the incidence of diabetes and cardiovascular disease dramatically, just absolutely dramatically. We can get a woman like Lydia, I think was the name before, to quit smoking. Start walking instead, and that will help minimize any weight gain from the quitting of smoking, which is a huge issue in women, obviously. We're really going to be ahead of the game. So we need women to do some form of brisk walking for a half hour a day. It doesn't have to be in 30 consecutive minutes. It could be 3 10-minute walks. I've been known to take 2 20-minute power walks in a day when I have a slow day in the office. You want to walk fast enough to work up a sweat. If you can't walk, you do something else. You could do Tai Chi, yoga. You get on a Stairmaster or elliptical machine. You can swim. There's always something people can do. The second component of exercise would be some form of resistance training. Muscle chews up triglycerides and chews up blood sugar and chews up that toxic stew that comes out of the midsection. So if we can build and or preserve muscle mass, we are ahead of the game. And we lose 1% of our muscle mass every year after high school. Probably most of our listeners are in that category. So anything we can do to promote healthy muscle mass increase, upper body resistance training, maybe, you know, let's say 20 minutes, 2 or 3 times a week on non-consecutive days. And there are many self-help books out there. I'd be happy to put some, you know, on the website as to how women can do resistance training. So we're talking about
and that's going to be covered on the PCOS Challenge television show, which is going to be on the website in December. And,
fantastic.
Interval training, resistance training is It has a really big impact on people. And
absolutely
like
fantastic.
Said,
and the way to motivate midlife women to exercise is not to tell women, you know, that this is good for you, it's going to lower your triglycerides. We have to convince women that they will feel better. This has been studied a number
absolutely.
Of times by, you know, perhaps some other people have been on your show, but there's, you know, terrific published data now that the way to motivate women, midlife women, to exercise is to emphasize the immediate return, stress reduction, feeling better, looking better, better posture. I mean, your friends and neighbors will be to tell immediately something's going on. You look different. You're walking at a snappier pace. Your posture's better. We need to get people out there moving.
Thanks.
Let me just give you, I know we may run into time limitations, but just something brief about diet. I'm certainly not a nutritionist, but I would make the statement that every woman with PCOS should see a board-certified, licensed nutritionist, dietitian-type person at one time or the other. And what we're trying to do here is modest weight loss, even 5 to 10% of weight loss. Your typical 150-pound woman who loses 15 pounds will have a tremendous impact upon how she feels when getting rid of this toxic stew of factors causing arterial clogging. And we're talking a standard, you know, Mediterranean-style diet with calorie restriction, lots of fruits and vegetables, whole grains, and trying to avoid concentrated sweets and high saturated fat foods. Just very simple, you know, common sense stuff. That's what we need to do. You combine that with exercise, you can dramatically reduce the impact of this toxic stew we've been talking about.
You'll feel different. You'll feel better. You want to do things. You want to keep going back for more. You know, you want to keep exercising. So.
Absolutely. It's very sad that the percentage of the American public who does regular exercise, and the American Heart Association says a half hour a day of at least brisk walking, and a very small percentage of the American public gets that in.
That's difficult. Well, I have to mention that a high percentage of the PCOS population deals with depression and anxiety.
Yes.
A lot of them are agoraphobic. They don't want to go outside. They don't want to, you know, so this does impact the motivation level to go out and walk or be
sure.
around people. And yeah, so there are certain other things that play a part in this. However, it really is about the motivation level. If you can motivate yourself to out of, you know, your depression and anxiety symptoms, sometimes that'll work, and you know, you'll see great results if you find yourself being able to go out and, you know, just do something, just do it, like you said.
Absolutely.
However, that's an even deeper issue sometimes for some people.
Absolutely, and we are now finding that that psychological factors such as depression and anxiety are major risk factors for cardiovascular disease. When I was at the Cleveland Clinic yesterday, everyone who has a trip to the coronary care unit for a heart attack or stroke or anything else, they always get a psychological consult, and so they're paying a lot of attention to risk factors like depression. Before we run out of time, Sasha, I just want to mention a couple of other drug classes. If lifestyle fails, let's say we're following a pretty good lifestyle, we've made changes, we still have evidence that this toxic stew is in operation, our non-HDL cholesterol is high, the triglycerides are high, et cetera, and we have to go to medications. Certainly, metformin, your listeners are familiar with, doesn't do a lot to the things I'm talking about here today as far as the blood lipids. So it's not really a lipid management drug. The hypertension medications, there are many fantastic, easy-to-tolerate, once-a-day hypertension medications out there. Many of them are generic now, so they're not that costly. When it comes to cholesterol-lowering drugs, I just want to make sure we get this in case we run out of time. There's a general fear in the public of the main class of cholesterol-lowering drugs, which are the statins, drugs like Lipitor, Crestor, Vytorin, et cetera. And I must say that these drugs work, and they work in women, and they are safe. We always use therapeutic lifestyle change, diet, exercise, et cetera, first. But if we can't get the goal in a patient with increased risk, we can and should use the statin drugs. They work. They're safe. They do not harm the liver. They can be used even in cases with people who have mild liver dysfunction. There's a high incidence, I'm sure, in PCOS patients of fatty liver, which is the fastest growing form of liver disease in America today, where these lipids are getting deposited not only in the artery wall, but also in the liver, rendering it malfunctional. So if we have to use medications, you know, the statins are safe. There's sometimes some minor annoying side effects, but they work. You have to take them. The efficacy of these drugs needs to be monitored by a physician who knows what he's doing and following the correct parameters, like getting that non-HDL cholesterol down to goal, et cetera. So there's been a tremendous backlash, really, over the last 10, 15 years against the statins, and it's unjustified, in my opinion. The statins are the best drugs we have to lower the predominance of cholesterol-laden particles in the bloodstream. So they do work. They do reverse plaque buildup. They do prevent events.
Now, when do people usually get to the point where lifestyle changes don't work, aren't effective, and you have to go to medications?
Well, it's highly variable for each patient. We're starting to get some insight now. We do some advanced genetic testing through the lab. I mentioned HDL, where you can actually begin to predict who's going to respond to diet and lifestyle and who isn't. Some patients have so many of these bad LDL particles in the bloodstream, Sasha, that we just can't get it down with diet and lifestyle. So if somebody is very high risk, we begin medication along with diet and lifestyle changes. So it's for each patient, it's going to be different. You know, there are patients who try their best. They really get out there and do everything they can, and they still have this what we call residual risk. We reassess the risk. We measure the LDL particles in the bloodstream. They're still too high. So that's when we have to begin medication. And many clinicians
are these due to genetic factors?
That's exactly what I was going to say.
Years and decades.
Factors.
Okay,
yeah.
Good. Uh-huh.
I use the analogy of a patient swimming against a strong genetic tide. Sometimes there's a tide of genetic factors that make the patient make it necessary to take a medication. So it's sometimes problematical in women, obviously. Women in their 30s and 40s, the statins are contraindicated in situations where women can become pregnant. So women would have to practice rigorous birth control and obviously understand that you can't get pregnant while you're on a statin. But the disease is building in the arteries in the 30s and 40s. There's no doubt about it. And that is the time to begin aggressive prevention.
Well, you know, I want to talk about the omega fatty acids.
Sure.
A lot of people are confused about them. And so I do want to talk about the guidelines for getting enough omega-3s, what are omega-3s versus omega-6s. People are still, there is even a recent controversy about omega-6s. We won't get into that. We don't have enough time. But
sure.
I do want you to mention those.
Absolutely. Well, the omega-3s are once again a fat that is essential for life. There's evidence, and omega-3s we typically think of as the fish oils, EPA and DHA. These are long-chain omega-3s. You can get shorter-chain omega-3s and things like flaxseed oil, et cetera. But it appears that the most evidence for cardiovascular prevention comes from the long-chain omega-3s that occur in marine fish oils, fish such as salmon, tuna, sardines, the sort of cold water predatory fish. If you go to the supermarket and look at tilapia and orange roughy and flounder and such, less fishy tasting fish, these are low in omega-3s, salmon and tuna much higher. So the American Heart Association recommends that most Americans, particularly those at risk, have about 2 servings of fatty fish per week, salmon and or tuna. Now, you can also start taking omega-3 supplements if you're at risk, and I put all my we actually have a test available through the HDL lab where we can quantitate omega-3 in the red blood cells. So we can now monitor whether the patient is reaching a goal, and then we can increase their intake with either a supplement or diet. So omega,
wonderful.
Yeah, it's really amazing. And what we've seen is almost everyone is deficient.
Not everyone.
But almost everyone. So we can actually monitor that. Why do we care about omega-3s? Because they help prevent sudden death. There's evidence they in high doses that they lower triglycerides. There's evidence that they may that they lower inflammation and plaques. So the omega-3s are a very good healthy fat that we want to pay a lot of attention to in women who are at risk, such as PCOS women.
Okay.
Oh,
all
and
right,
I should mention
I'm
one more
gonna...
thing. That one more common misnomer is that omega-3 supplements, such as fish oil supplements, do not lower cholesterol. So I see many patients who think, well, I don't want to take a drug. I want to do it with fish oils. And although the fish oil supplements are helpful at preventing atherosclerosis and atherosclerotic events, they don't lower cholesterol. So they cannot be used as a substitute for statins. That's a common, very common misconception I see online and in my patients. So I wanted to correct that.
Oh, well, yeah, thanks for clearing that up. I know you said that they, over time, help to lower triglycerides.
Yes, in very high doses. Okay. And we're talking the typical over-the-counter standard fish oil supplement, you'd have to take 15 or 16 of these a day, which is pretty unpalatable, to really get a significant triglyceride-lowering effect. So when someone has very high triglycerides, 3, 4, 500, we're often going to use prescription omega-3s to reduce the number of capsules a patient has to take.
Okay, and I know we're running out of time, but I do want to get to this this listener
question. Sure. I'm never out of time on this topic. Let me know when you have to give me the hook.
Okay, so Anonymous, she says she has depression, high blood pressure, high cholesterol, and she's insulin resistant. She's taking antidepressants and a statin to lower her cholesterol. She also wants to become a mother, so, you know, the statin might not be a good drug to be on while trying to get pregnant. So, but she's depressed about all the medicine that she has been prescribed, so she wants to now know what's the best thing for her to do to get off the medications. She tried to exercise and eat right, but sometimes she lacks the motivation. And we did talk a little bit about this before.
Right.
But I wanted to get her question answered.
Well, certainly, I would say, as you correctly pointed out, you cannot be on a statin and get pregnant. You have to prevent that. So we need to stop the statin. There's no hard and fast rule on this. There's no research. But I would certainly say stop the statin, let's say 3 months before you attempt to get pregnant. There's really no data on that, but I think that would be prudent. The statins get out of the system pretty fast. We see effects of the statins in lowering cholesterol in about a week. So the reverse is probably also true.
Wow.
In terms of trying to do this in a non-pharmacological fashion, I can tell you one of my goals this year has been to look at non-pharmacologic products, look at some of the supplements out there and see how we can integrate that into the standard Western approach of you got a problem, I'll give you a pill. And I must tell you, the results have been somewhat disappointing so far. There are most of the supplements out there have very little data compared to products like statins, very little data that they work, and very little safety data that they can be taken safely.
Mm-hmm.
So for a woman like this, we really have to leverage nutrition and lifestyle as much as possible. We need a structured program, you know, beginning perhaps with a visit to a licensed, registered dietitian, to design a program for this patient. And, you know, I don't know if we can mention names of companies or anything. I have asked you that question before, but there are a number of companies nationally that have structured programs. We're using a company called Metagenics in our office, which has a 12-week structured program using a high-protein, plant-based diet along with a Mediterranean diet and very frequent nutritional lifestyle education follow-up, really 6 visits over 12 weeks. And we're just beginning this program, but we've already seen patients coming off medicines. Their sugar's dropping, so they're coming off their diabetic medicine in 2 weeks. Blood pressure reductions, we're seeing, you know, some really encouraging results, and the published literature supports this. So, you know, some form of structured program like that is that patient's best, is going to get them the best outcome.
Yeah, you know what? When I was first diagnosed with PCOS, and my doctor, I was diagnosed by a gynecologist, and she gave me a pamphlet and birth control and said, she told me that I shouldn't be upset about not getting my period because so many women don't want to get their periods.
Right.
But anyway, I digress.
And you may have found that condescending a little bit, I guess, right?
Just a little, just a tad.
Okay.
but one of the things I wanted to do was to see a dietitian, a nutritionist. However, my insurance wouldn't pay for it. They said that they wouldn't pay for it unless I had diabetes or cardiovascular disease or something.
Or renal failure. It's very sad to say, and I'm closely involved with dietitians, nutritionists. I mean, that's part of what a lipid center is. You know, it's a focus on cardiovascular risk reduction.
Absolutely.
And the use of ancillary personnel like that. So it really is a shame, you know, and I don't know the exact answer to that other than, you know, continuing pressure from groups like this group, you know, to get insurance coverage for primary prevention. We're a disease-oriented medical system. It's pay me now or pay me later. You know, we really need to emphasize prevention. And you know, that poor patient may have to pay out of pocket, you know, unfortunately,
that's what most people have to end up doing.
Mm. Yes.
So thank you for answering her question.
And absolutely.
So the next thing, we did talk a little bit about this just now, birth control pills. But it suggested that despite the many wanted and wonderful effects of birth control pills, there are also side effects that affect the heart, that affect heart function. Women with PCOS are often prescribed birth control pills as a first line of defense against PCOS. So what advice would you have to give women with PCOS who are on birth control pills when it comes to their cardiovascular health?
Well, the best advice you could give is certainly don't smoke. There's two words. That would be, you know, absolutely rule number one. There probably are some gynecologists who wouldn't even prescribe a birth control pill to women who smoke. But certainly in PCOS, where you have this toxic stew increasing the potential for blood to clot anyway, you don't want to mix a birth control pill with smoking. So that would be point number one.
Sticky platelets.
Right, the sticky platelets.
Right.
And I like to come up with these kind of graphical terms. In my lectures, we show what the arteries look like in people that have a lot of clogging, and it's not a pretty sight, particularly at a dinner meeting. So don't smoke. And number two would be to watch your triglycerides. You know, all oral estrogen products have the potential to increase triglycerides, and this is probably increasing cardiovascular risk. So you really need to make sure that the triglycerides are monitored. Now, since most birth control pills are going to have a progestin in there also, that lowers triglycerides. So there may be a balancing effect. Some of the commonly used oral products for PCOS patients like Yaz and a few of the others may cause a little bit less of a triglyceride increase, but PCOS patients are going to be very sensitive to that. So make sure those, you know, that the triglycerides are monitored.
But they may cause hypokalemia as well.
I'll say that again. I'm sorry, I didn't hear the last word.
But they may increase potassium as well.
Potassium increase, with some of the with the treatments for PCOS that have an effect on the adrenal glands, where you're going to start reabsorbing more potassium. That is absolutely correct. So that has to be watched, particularly if you're on certain blood pressure medicines that can also increase potassium. But, you know, those would be your main risks, from taking the oral contraceptive pills. We have to watch out for interaction with smoking and increases in triglycerides also.
Dr. Pete, thank you so much for being here. I'm going to call it a night so that you can go and have some dinner.
I enjoyed it tremendously. I would love to do this again or find other forums where we can, you know, pursue this either in writing or...
We still have more questions.
Absolutely. Well, it sounds like we have to do it again.
Absolutely. Well, give us your contact information again so
sure.
that we know where to reach you.
For me, really the best way to get me is by email. It would be gpokmd@verizon.net. That's G as in Gregory, P as in Paul, OKMD as in medical doctor, .net. The information for the website is pretty simple. I managed to find it. It's mysite, mysite, .verizon.net, and then /gpokmd, gpokmd. So those are really the best ways to get me. All the contact information is there. And I'm widely available on the Internet and such if you Google me. So I'd be happy to help.
Yes, and you advocate for sea turtles.
I advocate for turtles in general. It's not a very cardiovascular. It's not an aerobic hobby, but it reduces stress. Let's put it that way.
Uh-huh. Great.
Right.
Well, I'm sure the turtles appreciate it, and we do too. Thank you. This was very informative. Thank you so much, and I can tell that you're a great lecturer.
Well, thanks, Sasha. I really don't do as much as I would like to do with the public, so I hope you can help me to get the message through about women and heart disease and strategies to prevent it, because I spend a lot of time lecturing to doctors and nurse practitioners and such, but I really would like to become more active with the public, and I hope we can continue to work together.
Absolutely, and I would like us to talk more about later in life for women, menopause.
Absolutely. The whole topic of hormone replacement therapy, menopause, and the changes that occur there, that's something I'm very interested in and would love to talk about. So,
So we'll talk again.
All right. Thanks to all, and good evening.
Thank you. Have a great evening.
Thank you for listening to the PCOS Challenge Radio Show. Tune in regularly to get insights from leading experts and the support you need. Also, be sure to join our social network at PCOSChallenge.com and sign up for our newsletter. This is Sasha Ati. Help spread the word and take the PCOS Challenge.